Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. I was going to try to not bring up any negative stories this week, but unfortunately, there are way too many to ignore. In fact, an incident that happened in my old neighborhood of Cleveland Heights brings out the absolute worst in me, feelings of rage and outrage. A woman named Mindy Manio, who is an experienced cyclist, was hit from behind and dragged before the driver stopped and then sped away. The police have described the car as a dark Buick LaCrosse four-door sedan from the 2005-2009 era. What kind of person hits something or someone and drives away? Mindy is recovering in the hospital right now, and anyone who might know anything about the accident is asked to please call Cleveland Heights Police, because if you contact me, I'm going to give you some really bad advice. So let's move on to our show. In his 1990 book, Greg LeMond's Complete Book of Bicycling, Greg wrote, quote, "It doesn't get easier, you just go faster," end quote. That phrase has been echoed by a lot of people over the years, and the truth is that the Peloton has gotten faster, as have the times for many other racing athletes, including runners and triathletes. This evening, Jim Gourley, author, triathlete, and yes, rocket scientist, talks with me about his new book, Faster, Demystifying the Science of Triathlon Speed. So do fatter tires make you go slower? What do you really know when you look at your power numbers? And is there such a thing as fast water in swimming? Jim will explain why it isn't just training or better equipment that makes you faster, and it doesn't get easier. I'll also speak with Thomas Prenn. Usually when I talk with Thomas, it's about what is happening with the company Cat Eye, since that's who he works with. Today, however, we're going to talk about Jamestown, Colorado, or at least what used to be Jamestown. Literally washed out in last month's floods, Thomas is helping Jamestown to rebuild the huge cycling community that lived there with a fundraising campaign called Cycle for Jamestown. Built in 1863, it only took 48 hours and 14 inches of rain to virtually destroy this little town. Now it will take over $25 million to rebuild it. If you go out to c4jtown.com, you'll see a short video of the utter devastation brought by the flooding. And more importantly, you'll get a sense of the community and why it is so important to rebuild it. There's also news to report, so let's get right to it and welcome rocket scientist, author, triathlete, Jim Gourley. Good evening, Jim. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I've been reading your new book, Faster, Demystifying the Science of Triathlon Speed, and I have to say that regardless of how geeky it is, I'm enjoying it.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you decided to use your engineering brain to get into this whole triathlon thing.
Well, I graduated from the United States Air Force Academy in 2002. And then immediately afterward, I got into the U.S. Army and served there. And so while I was in the Army, I was hanging out with a lot of these sort of type A personalities that they so typically get. And somebody just, you know, started mentioning one day, this guy and that guy and these other guys are all going and doing this triathlon thing. And I said, you know, what is this? And, you know, being sort of a type A guy myself and wanted to prove that I could keep up with all the other guys, I got into it. I think I did my first triathlon in about 2004. And, I think just about like every other athlete that gets into it, my first race was a complete disaster. I felt horrible afterward, and I was absolutely addicted.
It is addicting, isn't it?
Yeah, there's just something great about going through that type of experience, and I think, you know, pushing yourself to that limit, whether it's a, you know, a short, fast race or a really long, demanding race. There's just, I think, a certain group of people that like to do that.
I have a question about this work you did before you got into all the writing and the triathlon stuff. You really are a rocket scientist, huh?
Well, astronautical engineering is the, I guess, the appropriate term.
Oh, come on, rocket surgeon or whatever it is.
Yeah, and there were some people that went the rocket track. I stayed more on flight control systems.
So we
always joke about it. And yeah, I know a little bit about propulsion systems.
Including the human one, which is the one we're going to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so let's talk about faster. I mean, people want to be faster. And you actually talk about something called free speed. And I thought that was such a cool concept, that the premise of your book is that becoming fast isn't about equipment and training, doesn't have to cost a lot of money, because you can get free speed. How do you get free speed?
It's funny, because I think that because endurance racing, cycling, and triathlon got so technologically innovative at some point, it caused sort of a cultural shift among the athletes. 30, 40 years ago, you had cyclists and triathletes just sort of figuring things out by the seat of their pants. And as science got more and more involved, we got more data focused, we wanted better products, and we started trying to make this stuff. But I feel like in the last 10 years, the pendulum has sort of swung a little too far to the technology side.
Hear, hear.
And what I mean by that is we think that our speed is going to come from products. I need this wheel, that saddle, these shoes, that wetsuit, and that's all going to make me faster. And there's so much more emphasis on the technology and the products these days. And so much is left behind. Probably the most important things that are left behind are training and technique. We don't think about how we can improve ourselves and our own performance, which is sort of funny because that's the whole genesis of the thing, isn't it? I mean, we want to be better human athletes. And so we're constantly trying to upgrade the machine, and we leave behind the athlete. But at the end of the day, the same laws of physics apply to our bodies as the machines. And you're so much a bigger part of the equation than your bike or your shoes or your wetsuit. So that's where it's free, is in figuring out how those fundamental laws apply to you, and then using it to your advantage.
So let's look at your book a second. Your first chapter, Physics and the Triathlete. What is it that confuses people when you talk about things such as mass and weight or volume and density? I mean, you make it pretty clear that those are important things, but people tend to get the nomenclature or the meanings behind it kind of mixed up. So simplify it for us a little bit.
Here again, it's sort of a philosophical point, and this is a really great one I love to pull on people. What if I told you that I could save you 20 kilograms meters squared per second cubed?
Wow, I would be so impressed, except I don't have a damn idea what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Or what if I told you I could save you 20 newton meters per second? Interested?
Sure. You're always interested, except that it's not a real thing, is it?
But what if I told you I could save you 20 watts?
Why would you want to save watts?
If I could give you a product that would make you, or you know, an aerodynamic product,
so that you could produce more power
or get more speed for the power you're producing.
Oh, okay. Then of course my hand goes up. Sure, I want that.
Right, and a kilogram meter squared per second cubed, and a newton meter per second, and a watt are all the same thing. And I think that therein lies probably the best demonstration of what we're missing today as athletes. What is a watt? what does that represent? And we kind of forget the principles and the basic math behind all these words, and it causes us to lose perspective. And our relationship to all these extremely meaningful concepts becomes arbitrary and shallow in a way. And, that's not meant to insult anyone.
No, I understand.
But as a culture, we just immediately gravitate towards any marketing or advertising sign that says, save watts. But we don't have an understanding. So, anybody out there can pick up a book on physics even go to Wikipedia and look up a watt and figure that out. And there's value there. I mean, knowledge is power. Watts are a measurement of power. And so there's every bit as much value to knowing what a watt is as buying some sort of helmet or bike or something that claims to save you watts. And so what we need to do is, reconnect ourselves with the principles and figure out what they mean. Anytime you understand what it is you're dealing with, it's going to improve your performance.
I'm speaking with Jim Gourley. His new book is Faster, Demystifying the Science of Triathlon Speed. And the book is witty. It's fun. And it really simplifies a lot and demystifies, as he says, a lot of the sort of hype and gobbledygook of what's being sold to you in terms of equipment and, you need this, you should have this, this is going to make you faster, or fill in the blank. So I don't want to actually have a conversation about every chapter in the book, but can we answer one of the questions you pose in the swimming section? Because I thought it was an interesting thing. Is there such a thing really as fast water?
Outside of the Dead Sea, no. And here's why. We're talking about H2O. And so, water in one place is going to be very much like water in another place. And a lot of athletes have these debates about, what's water temperature going to do? Because water expands as it gets colder. So that means it's less dense. Maybe it's more dense. Oh, the water's warm. It gets more dense today. Oh, my gosh, there's salt water, so we're going to float more. And the bottom line at the end of all these arguments is that neither temperature nor the salinity of the water is going to make a significant difference in terms of your athletic performance. What a lot of people miss in these discussions is that word, significance. Yes, there's a difference, but is it really going to matter? It's like when you want to save weight on your bicycle. If I put an extra paper clip, if I tape a paper clip to your bicycle, are you really going to freak out that I have sabotaged your entire race by weighing down your bike? No, because it's not significant. And that's sort of what we're talking about with these situations. So anytime people like to say, well, there's this difference here, I say you have to consider the perspective. Are we talking about an ant level type of situation or a human size problem? And we're talking about human size problems. So like many of these considerations, no, there's not going to be any fast water for you out there.
So one of my favorite sub chapters in your books is Nobody Races in a Wind Tunnel. I was so happy to read that. Thank you. But let's talk about the chapter Numbers in the Real World. What happens to a rider in real riding conditions? So what is the real world, and what kind of numbers should they be looking at as opposed to what maybe they are looking at?
Well, you have asked the question that is the answer to all other questions.
Cool. I didn't know that.
The answer is, I think, again, we get back sort of to the philosophy of science.
Sure.
The real world is what you make of it, sort of. What are real world conditions? So, if you want to consider a real situation, the Hawaiian Ironman is this weekend. And everybody's making all sorts of prognostications about what the wind conditions are going to be. And, we really don't know until the race day comes. And the winds tend to do all sorts of crazy things. That's really the only consistent thing out there in Kona is inconsistency. By contrast, we do have the Norseman Triathlon, which is extremely cold. We've had blizzards in spring classics before. And I think even in the Tour de France a couple of times. And so the real world has this vast range of conditions, and it can go to all sorts of extremes. So you can really establish what your real world conditions are, anywhere you want. Now, that doesn't mean that a wind tunnel is useless. It just means that it's very hard for us to understand what's happening in the real world. And a wind tunnel takes out all that complexity. It simplifies things. And we use it as a tool to approximate specific conditions. So we always call a wind tunnel ideal conditions. Steady state airflow, and we're able to control the yaw angle, and the bike's not going over bumps, and all these things. We take away all those chaotic variables. And it's not to say that a wind tunnel is wrong. It's just that the reason they take away that chaos is that we're terrible actually at measuring chaos. I mean, when we talk about real world situations for a bike, I would say that what's happening in the real world is sort of this never ending series of miracles that keep us from winding up like Johnny Hoogerland tangled in the barbed wire. At the end of the day, what are we using wind tunnels to do? It's an approximation. Again, we're using that as a tool to guess what we think is going to happen in the real world. And we characterize certain behavior and conditions, and then we use the wind tunnel to design to that. So this is very important because it explains why every bike manufacturer out there or wheel or helmet manufacturer can come up with a different shape or design and still claim that they have the fastest bike or helmet, because they have established what they think the real world is, and they've designed their product based on that real world. So it's not lying. And I really want to punch that home, because I know there are a lot of people that like to try and play gotcha games with manufacturers. And some people throw their hands up in the air and say, it's all marketing bunk. And it's not. The differences in how people approach these things is very much based on technical and sound principles. It's just that different people have a different concept of what is the best kind of performance. One product's going to be developed for greater range of crosswinds. One product is going to be made for maybe a straighter airflow. Nobody rides nobody races in the wind tunnel, but at the same time, nobody goes and rides their velodrome bike at the Hawaiian Ironman.
Right.
And there's a reason why for that. So, different strokes for different folks and different bikes for different purposes. And at the end of the day, it's all about tools. So I think that it's very important to understand when you go into a situation and you're looking at data, you're trying to be a very discriminating consumer for your next product, that you don't just do an A to B comparison between products. It takes a little bit more research, and you have to get your hands dirty and understand what the manufacturer is trying to get at. Because anytime you just do the numbers comparison, it's going to be a little bit of apples to oranges. And so understanding the underlying philosophy with which the manufacturer approaches their quote-unquote real world is important. But I think there's enough of a range out there that people can find what it is they're looking for and find somebody that's designing something that matches sort of their concept of the world as well.
Excellent point. I totally agree. We're talking again with Jim Gourley. His new book is Faster, Demystifying the Science of Triathlon Speeds. We're sort of talking in generalities, but I can tell you that there's a lot of specific information in the book and lots of charts, lots of numbers. If you're into data, there's lots of data. So you and I kind of agree about tires, and I don't want to get into a big tire discussion. I want you to make the point about tire width, rim, shape, and depth, and speed. Just in a general sense, what a tire will do or not do. And choice of tires really has, in my opinion, something to do with conditions, too.
Yeah, you know, tires, I think, is probably one of those subjects where people are the most... I don't want to say misled, because I don't think there's anybody leading. I think that there's just not a lot of thought put into it. And when we do think about it, a lot of it's, I think we try to be intuitive. The more, you know, layman athletes I talk to, the more I hear reference to ice skates or locomotive wheels. You know, I hear people say all the time, well, look at ice skates. You know, they're really thin and they go for a long ways on the ice. It's an extremely efficient mode of travel because it's thin, you know, small contact patch, and that's what you want. Or some people, you know, think, well, locomotive wheels are made of solid steel and the train tracks are made of steel. So hard surface to hard surface, right? So I need to pump those tires up to where, you know, it's like, you know, on a stealth bomber type pressure. And both of those are misguided because you're dealing with something quite different. Those principles don't quite apply. And what we know from research that's been done is that increasing pressure reduces rolling resistance only up to a certain point, only to about 110, 120 PSI. And then after that, you really hit a point of diminishing returns. And I think what people notice is that ride quality decreases. So you hear a lot of people talking about, you know, I'm not pumping my tires up that high because it just makes the ride too bumpy for me. But even the people that are trying to gut it out to improve the rolling resistance, you're not getting enough benefit for the pain you're enduring. So just go ahead and let some of that air out. Now, the numbers I've seen were published by David Gordon Wilson, who is an instructor at Massachusetts Institute of Technology and wrote the book Bicycling Science, which I absolutely defer to. He's a much smarter guy than I am. But his numbers showed, like I said, after about 110 PSI, the gains just aren't there anymore. It sort of just peters out. Now the numbers he had were a little old. So I don't know if tire manufacturers have done different things in the last 10 years and that things have changed. And so that's why I tell people, go with the recommended pressure. I've heard stories about professional athletes running as low as 85 PSI. I can't confirm that. It's somewhat urban legend. I'm not sure. But even then, there's sort of that curve there that says that 85 would be too low. They could still actually get some gain by running upwards of 110. So I think that sort of illustrates a trend we see in these types of things where people like to go to extremes because they always think that more of something or less of something is better. So get the absolute least or absolute most possible. And that's not true. Oftentimes in engineering, what we're talking about is optimization, the greatest good for the lowest cost. And that leads us to a happy medium. You sort of want to be like Goldilocks in the Three Bears house. Find the point that's just right. So what I would recommend to athletes is go towards you know, the recommended pressure. It's recommended for a reason. When we get to the point about tire width, if a wider tire always made your bike more efficient, well, we'd all be riding fat bikes by now in the Tour de France and over the cobbles. And obviously, we're not doing that. And I'm sure there's a UC reg that says you can't anyway. There's another reason for it. And then at a certain point, your tire patch, a wider tire patch, does improve your rolling resistance. It lowers your rolling resistance. But at a certain point, making that tire wider and wider and wider adds mass. It increases weight. It will increase somewhat the rotational inertia. And these properties are going to, at a point, overwhelm any gains you make in rolling resistance. So again, a happy medium. The final factor that's sort of come from the manufacturer and engineering side of the house is aerodynamics. And I know Josh Portner at Zip has talked about this, and Leonard Zinn as well. But a lot of bikes these days have sort of settled on the 23-millimeter tire. That's the standard that Zip designed their Firecrest wheels to. And they designed that tire specifically to fit with a 23-millimeter tire and conform the entire profile shape to something that was streamlined. And so what they've said is that if you go to a 25-millimeter tire, it degrades the aerodynamic performance. And at a sufficient speed, aerodynamics, again, will also trump rolling resistance. So, you know, you get back to a point of what's your real world? So all those conditions are considerations, and you know, it's based on what you do.
Wow. So, believe it or not, we actually have been having this conversation for a half hour. We haven't even begun to really delve into your book, and we are out of time. So here's my offer, and I hope you'll take it. I would like to come back and revisit some of the other things in your book in the not too distant future. So I'm going to ask if you will do that, and we can talk about another couple of aspects. I would like to talk about swimming a little bit, and I'd like to talk about running a little bit. But yeah, for this evening, I'm afraid we are out of time. It is Faster, Demystifying the Science of Triathlon Speed. It is a VeloPress book, and it really is no nonsense. It is just really logical stuff. And if you're like me, and I'm not always logical, you need somebody to bring you back down to the real world, and this is real world. So, Jim, thank you so much for spending time with me on the show this evening, and we'll come back. Will you come back and talk to me again?
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure being here. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Have a great night.
Sure thing. Thanks.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
On Sunday, October 20th, put on your hiking shoes and join Cleveland Metro Parks for a castle hike at North Chagrin Reservation. Enjoy scenic fall vistas on several trails as you learn more about the short life of a grand estate once planned for the acreage surrounding the landmark Squire's Castle. This hike steps off at 1:30 p.m. from the North Chagrin Nature Center, located off Buttermilk Falls Parkway in Mayfield Village. More information at 440-473-3370 or visit clevelandmetroparks.com.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees, and it's time for some news. Even as news of a wave of retirements by professional cyclists was announced this week, several veteran riders have been scooped up by teams for the 2014 season. In a Velo News article titled Wave of Retirements Sweeps Across the Peloton as Year Ends, Andrew Hood writes of many riders desperately looking for teams while some riders are being hired for non-competitive positions. Hood wrote, Marco Pignatti, who announced his retirement on Thursday, was one of the lucky ones. The 37-year-old Italian leaves the sport untarnished by doping scandals and will slot into a new position at BMC Racing, where he will work as a coach alongside the team's performance director, Alan Piper, and former pro Bobby Dulick. I'm happy with how my career went. I look back to 15 years ago. I didn't think I was going to have a career like this, Pignatti told Velo News contributor Gregor Brown. I wasn't one of the biggest or best talents of my generation, but I was able to obtain what I did thanks to my work. Then there was Mikel Astarloza, the Basque climber who tested positive for EPO ahead of the 2009 tour, a charge he denied. Astroloza, who's 33, would have liked to have raced a few more seasons, but with his Euskaltel-Euskadi team folding, he couldn't find a new ride. "I would have liked to have continued, but I will be 34 next year," Astroloza said last week. "Considering the circumstances, I felt it was the right time to make a change." In contrast, Bjorn Riis and Alberto Contador had their foundering team saved when Saxo Bank stepped up with some financial help this week. From Madrid, Bjorn Riis dodged a bullet after Danish investment bank Saxo Bank stepped up for its commitment to keep the team alive for 2014. Riis has been struggling to fill the 6 million euro funding gap left with the acrimonious departure of Russian businessman Oleg Tinkov. Saxo Bank, which has been a Riis sponsor since 2008, has promised financial backing to guarantee the team for 2014 in what's an important season for Alberto Contador to take on Chris Froome and Sky. So begins the 2014 season. In more domestic news from the Hudson Reporter Online from Hudson County, New Jersey, the federal court rules in favor of Jersey City Embankment Coalition and Rails to Trails over 6th Embankment. This is kind of an interesting story from Jersey City. A section of railroad tracks in New Jersey is less likely to become a residential development following a court ruling last week. U.S. District Court Judge Amy Berman has granted a summary judgment to the City of Jersey City, the Embankment Preservation Coalition, and the Rails to Trails Conservancy regarding the Jersey City's 6th Street embankment. In 2005, Conrail sold the Harsimus Branch embankment to 8 commonly owned limited liability companies for development without going through a federal abandonment process that is required of rail lines. Believing that the embankment was subject to rail abandonment laws, the city, the Embankment Preservation Coalition, and Rails to Trails requested that the Surface Transportation Board, the federal agency that has authority over rail abandonments, intervene. The Surface Transportation Board decided in favor of the 3 plaintiffs, and the decision was appealed. The case bounced around the federal court system for years while various courts examined whether the plaintiffs had standing in the matter and other issues. Last year, the case was returned to U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. Since then, the LLCs that purchased the land have charged their position that the Harsimus Branch was a rail spur, not subject to federal regulation. They filed a joint stipulation with the plaintiffs that the branch was indeed a line of rail, and Conrail raised no objection. Referring to this turnabout, Judge Berman wrote in her decision, quote, "The parties have stipulated to the sole factual issue in this case. No genuine issues of material fact remain, and plaintiffs are entitled to judgment as a matter of law." Judge Berman's decision can be appealed, but the plaintiffs are calling it a milestone in the long legal battle over the embankment. So we'll see if New Jersey gets their rail trail from this abandoned railway from Conrail. I would think maybe eventually they will. Who knows? So two of my pet peeves on bicycle trails are stop signs at the end of a downhill that abut onto a road, and then extensive stop signs on trails in general. And evidently, Ohio isn't alone in these issues. My friend and colleague, Carrie Caffrey, is also peeved by the abundance of stop signs in Orlando and is doing something about it. Enter the, quote, stop sign reduction project, end quote. You can read all about this at commuteorlando.com, but here's a brief overview of Carrie's work. Most of the stop signs in question do not meet the criteria to justify them. The examples in my presentation include stop signs at streets with less traffic than the trail. Well, that makes sense. Stop signs at private driveways. The path is a public right-of-way. It has priority over a private driveway. Stop signs on side paths where the intersecting street traffic is required to stop or yield before entering the adjacent roadway. That traffic is required by statute to yield to traffic on a sidewalk or side path. Stop signs where sight lines are sufficient for yield signs and walk bike regulatory placards, which are not supported by any statute and thus not legal. And there's a lot more going on with this if you go again to commuteorlando.com. But Finally, she says, in a perfect world, one could look at all of the above intersections where the stop signs are clearly unwarranted and simply yank them out. But this isn't a perfect world. This is a world governed by layers of bureaucracy, frozen by fear of litigation and public backlash. And like it or not, that's the system we're working with. Ba-dum-bump. So hopefully they'll get some stop sign removal down in Florida, and then maybe other states can look to that for direction on what to do for themselves. I've been following a story in Georgia, and it's cyclists won, state legislature zero as of this week. In what would have been the most anti-bicycling legislation ever written, according to the executive director of Georgia Bikes, Brent Bice, House Bill number 689 went down in flames when Carl Rogers, Lee Hawkins, and Emery Donahue, three Republican representatives of the Georgia General Assembly, capitulated their position in a hearing this past Monday in Gainesville, Georgia. Over 300 cyclists showed up to express their displeasure of the regressive bill, which read, and this is pretty horrendous, a bill to be entitled to act to amend Title 40 of the Official Code of Georgia, annotated relating to motor vehicle and traffic, so as to provide for registration and licensing of bicycles, to revise a definition, to provide for the acquisition of a license plate prior to the operation of a bicycle on streets with motor vehicle traffic, to provide for the design of license plates for bicycles, to provide for the option of a one-time bicycle registration fee in lieu of annual registration, to prescribe fees for annual and one-time registration of bicycles, to provide a requirement for the operation of bicycles upon a roadway, and to authorize the establishment of rules and regulations, to provide for enforcement, to provide for related matters, to repeal conflicting laws, and for other purposes. And blah, 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 blah. It was literally, these guys evidently showed up at this meeting in Gainesville, Georgia. 300 cyclists also showed up, and they basically turned around and said, oh, well, we just wanted to see, you know, if this was going to go anywhere. It went nowhere, absolutely nowhere. We're going to hear from Thomas Prenn in a few moments. And one of the places he is going and will tell us about is to India. And this, speaking of regressive bicycle laws, came up in the newsfeed. Actually, this came up on our Facebook page. Somebody who lives in India pretty much begged me to please let people know about what's going on in Kolkata, India, which is the capital of the Indian state of West Bengal. Joynath Nandi, who lives in India, asked that I mention the regressive law and the petition that is now in circulation from change.org to lift the ban. I found an article in indiatoday.in. It's another first for Kolkata, it begins. It has now become the first city in India to impose a blanket ban on bicycles in almost all major parts of the city. However, many describe the police logic as impractical and regressive. Ekta Jaju, a social entrepreneur and part of the Cycle Satyagraha campaign, says, when you have less road space, then cycles should be encouraged rather than asking people to bring out their cars. We are going a step backwards, and this is just a car-centric approach. Kolkata is home to 14 million people, and commuters here make more than 2.5 million trips every day. It is also the only major city in India where the number of cycle rides is greater than the number of car journeys. So the decision is an extension to the ban that was imposed on 38 streets in 2008. It now covers almost the entire stretch of the city between 7 a.m. and 11 p.m. Citizens and activists are vehemently opposing the ban and want the government to revoke the decision. From the milkman to newspaper vendors and students, so many people depend on it. At a time when the entire world is promoting green vehicles like bicycles, this is baffling, said Gautam Shroff of cycling group Right to Breathe. Shroff says, given the critical condition of the air in the city, it is imperative that people are encouraged to use environmentally friendly modes of transportation like the bicycle. Don't we want a better and greener Kolkata? It is the lung cancer capital of the country, and pollution is at a critical level here. The bottom line is that the West Bengal Transport Minister Madan Mitra has defended the decision. He says the government was merely following the conventions put in place since the British era stating that allowing cycles indiscriminately will only lead to further chaos. Just imagine if everyone starts plying on the roads in and around Writers Building using bicycles. There will be complete chaos, adds the minister. Don't know. Change.org, Kolkata, K-O-L-K-A-T-A, is the city in India. Wow. So my final note is the cutest video of the week. If you have ever been to a site called jibjab.com, J-I-B-J-A-B, just type in bicycle birthday and you'll see this really cute card. That is our news for today. We're going to trot on out to Boulder, Colorado, and welcome back Thomas Prynne to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thomas, thanks for joining me this evening.
Great, and it's very nice to be back.
I want to talk about what happened in Colorado with the floods and especially about the little town of Jamestown. So you live in Boulder. What's the proximity of Boulder to Jamestown, and what is this big interest in this tiny little town?
Well, Jamestown is a sort of the perfect Saturday or Sunday morning ride from Boulder. It's it's about a half an hour north on kind of flat roads, and then you take a left and you start heading up the canyon, and you go up Left Hand Canyon, and towards the end it gets a little steeper, and you're rewarded with this quaint little town after about almost about an hour of riding, and you're in the town of Jamestown, which is a very, very small town. There are two stop signs. Well, let's put it this way. There were two stop signs.
Yeah, and that's what we're going to talk about.
In around September 11th, we had the beginning of what was a very unusual weather event where we just kept getting this cycle of rain getting dumped right in the same spot every single day. And so over the course of about 7 days, and really most of it was all on three different evenings, Boulder got 18 and a half inches of rain, and that is our entire year's worth of rain in what is typically the driest month of the year.
Really?
Yeah. So this was not only extremely unusual. It was, they say now this is probably not a 100-year flood event. This is a 500-year flood event. Although the way weathers have been going, it could be a 10-year event.
Right. Exactly.
So we just don't know. But the fact was is we were just completely dumped with rain, and so much in such a short amount of time in the evenings. When that much water hits a mountainside and a valley, there's no way for it to go except down the valley, and it caused obviously the nice little stream that went through Jamestown to not only overflow its banks, but also to loosen the hillside, and there were mudslides and a torrent of water that went down for several days and destroyed about half the homes, destroyed the entire sort of the Merck, as they call it, the Mercantile, which is a old building from the probably 70s or 80s, something like that, when probably Jamestown was formed, and just the post office, the church, everything was just completely destroyed.
Do you know how many people actually reside in Jamestown?
I don't.
It's small.
I really don't. It's hundreds of people. But it's a small town. It's a very small town. I forget how many families live there as well too. But the cyclists sort of thought, not only is the road completely destroyed to Jamestown. In fact, it'll probably be a year before you can ride to Jamestown again. The roads are so destroyed. Today, just riding up towards where you would make that turn off to Jamestown, I actually turned around where the highway, the U.S. Highway 36, goes to one lane because a bridge was so severely damaged. And, you know, that's still going to be months before that's fixed. And that's not even in the canyon where the real damage occurred, which is just washing roads out entirely. So there's a threat that the town of Jamestown could completely go away, because if there is not sufficient money raised locally, FEMA will not come in and actually kick in their amounts of money. So there's a real threat that the town of Jamestown could go away. So the cyclists have gotten together, and we're putting together a fantastic event, all on just volunteer time and efforts. It's going to be a big event on the 19th in Boulder. And unfortunately, I'm not going to be here.
No, we'll talk about that, because what you're doing is pretty exciting too. But anyway, you are helping on the this end of it. So, what is going to be needed to restore the town? I mean, will they need also hands-on, or is it basically funds?
Well, right now they're going to need hands-on, and they do actually have that. But it's really because it's no one's allowed to go there. I mean, you can't even go. I mean, the roads are closed.
Well, how are people getting supplies in and out, or has everybody been sort of airlifted out of the town? Is there anybody there?
Well, I believe that there's no one there during the day, there's only people there during the day, and they come in, they have to come in through a mountain road, because that's the only access to the town. And so we're actually organizing a shovel event. In other words, sending some volunteers up on Sunday, and they're really having to limit it to how many people can be there, because it's a there's so much destruction. There's so much, you know, personal property that's still probably strewn across, you know. And this is a month ago. This happened a month ago.
Right.
It's still, if you could imagine, this is how sort of horrific the damage has been, that even after a month, people still can't get to their house and get their stuff out and things like that. A lot of people were airlifted out of there. All of the canyon roads had been destroyed. Even right now, you still can't get to Estes Park. Estes Park's a pretty big town. I don't
right.
know what you're doing. So,
well, that was one of the questions I wanted to ask, sort of.
Yeah.
So Jamestown, it was a beautiful little town, and obviously the people want to rebuild it. There's no question that they're not going to let it die. So what else has happened in Colorado? How has the flood affected let's look at the bicycle business, because that's what you and I know.
Yeah. You know, luckily that we were really the season of cycling was starting to wind down. So
true.
In talking with a couple of retailers, it hasn't had that tremendous effect right now. I don't think that anyone has really necessarily noticed a decline in sales specifically because of this. It might have an effect next year, because it could still be difficult to go on a lot of the road rides that we all like to do. Hopefully by spring, though, you know, most of, or at least some of the canyons will have been rebuilt. I think trail access right now is still a big issue for people who want to go on mountain bike rides. I mean, so much of the trails just were really destroyed, because there was so much water. If you can imagine, there's so much water. There were creeks and rivers formed that had never been there before. I mean, it was just that much water. So it's going to be, I think right now everyone's sort of cautious about the industry. It really hasn't had a tremendous negative effect on anything in terms of sales or anything.
Good.
People are still going out for rides. They just have to find specific places to ride these days. So, you can't go on all of the same usual rides that you normally used to do. So, the other thing, the way it also is not, we haven't been so affected, because this time of year it starts to get cool. People ride less and less into the mountains, because it's you turn around and you come down and you freeze.
Right, exactly. You better have your clothes ready. Let me take a moment and remind our listeners, we're speaking with Thomas Prenn. He's out in Boulder, Colorado. He's talking about what happened to this little town that cyclists tend to go to, Jamestown, and how it was just virtually destroyed by the floods in September. Were you at Interbike? I didn't see you.
I was at Interbike. I have a new role at Cat Eye.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, I have a sort of mouthful of a title. It's Global Strategic Business and Product Innovation Director. I'm working independently for Cat Eye Japan, which means I'm sort of back to where I was before we started Cat Eye America, where I work independently, and so I'm going to be doing some independent research for some other companies and some other things. So I'll be more actively involved in the bike industry, not solely for Cat Eye, but doing some other things as well, and I have some projects that certainly you would be very interested in. I'm very, very concerned about cyclist safety, and there have been a couple of deaths recently that I just think were in Boulder or in Colorado in particular that I think were avoidable just if people had greater awareness, not just of cyclists but cyclists of motorists and what motorists face. So I'm working to try to put together some funds to make some safety videos, and I haven't quite figured out who that's going to be done for, how, or whatever, but there's some safety videos that I want to have made.
It's a great idea. A great idea. Awesome.
So I have some free time. I have some with a new role. I have I love what I do because it's coming up with the next greatest product, and we've sort of neglected that for the past 2 years while we've been getting Cat Eye America up to speed. So, and we got some great ideas. I mean, we have some
good,
really fantastic ideas that we're working on. So
right before we actually went on air, you were telling me about something really exciting that you're about to do. And why don't you tell us what that is?
Well,
it's very cool.
Interesting thing. I through my book, Racing Tactics for Cyclists. I have an association with Hunter Allen and his coaching group. I've been to several of his camps, and I was actually at his house last month, actually. And we were riding for a couple of days and talking about some things and working on some product ideas. What happened was one of their coaches sent some of my books over to a professional team in India, and believe it or not, there's a little bit of a professional racing circuit starting to evolve in India. They have two pro teams, and one of the pro teams has Hunter Allen's coaching group working with them, and they got these books and devoured them. Got about 20 more, and they have invited me over to conduct a training camp in December. So I'm very excited and also a little worried because these guys like to race uphill really fast.
What are you saying there, Thomas, that you're not ready to do that? Well, that's what motorcycles are for, you know?
true. Well, it's actually kind of interesting, too, when you look at it. But they love to do what is easy for them to do, and what is hard for them to do are actually the race tactics. So I'll be sort of having to sort of direct them back to the flats and saying, okay, now we got to learn to actually make a successful attack and counterattack.
Sure.
How we do it. So it's really very, very, very exciting because these are guys who are just really hungry for any sort of information. It's like a group of really excited Category 5 racers who just want to like just do everything they possibly can to get faster and better, and so I'm really excited about that. It's a short trip. I'll just be over there for less than a week, but
it occurs to me when you're talking about this, we're seeing the emergence of teams coming out of Africa. Now we're talking India. And are we finally going to see some of these world tour, these big grand races, the spring classics and everything else, better represented worldwide from worldwide teams? This is a pretty exciting thing.
Well, it is, and I think that, you know, everyone, I can guarantee you, everyone that's going to be at this training camp plus more are all waiting, you know, they're all vying to be the first pro to get a European pro team, you know, contract and to move up the ranks to that. So I think you will see it. I mean, China is definitely emerging as a cycling market and as an area where people are actually racing, and I think that you're going to see that more and more because you get people who are passionate about the sport. I mean, the gentleman who's helping put the whole camp on, he went to the University of Wisconsin, so he came back to India, you know, worked in business for many, many years, and thought, gosh, I really miss my cycling, and you know, here he's now bringing cycling back to his home country. So it is very exciting to be part of this.
I love the idea of more diversity in cycling. It's just exciting, whether it's women as well as men or people coming from other parts of the world. I think it's awesome not to just have, you know, Eastern or Western Europeans and Americans racing. I mean, for a long time, we didn't even have Americans racing in Europe. So, you know, we were the new boys on the block.
It might be just another 10 years, and you'll see riders from Asia really in there just the same way that the Americans have been recently. So who knows?
Well, I can't wait to hear what you have to say when you get back from India. And I would like if you would just tell us what the website is so people can go out and see what's going on with the Jamestown fundraiser. I'm going to put it up on our Facebook page, but why don't you tell the listeners what that is, and then I'm going to let you move on.
The website's a very, very simple website. It's C as in cyclist, the letter C, and then the number 4, and then J, letter J, town.com. And I think also .org works too, but you'll get there and it says Cyclists for Jamestown. And there's a great video about the town. And, you know, very simple way to go on there and donate. And it's going to be a fantastic event. Anyone who can make it out will just—I'm sure they're going to have fun, just being part of this whole thing because it's really a groundswell of activity from everyone in on the Front Range to put this together because so many people have ridden to Jamestown. It's such a great place to ride. So,
I really thank you for taking time to speak with me this evening and to tell us your thoughts on what's going on. Have a wonderful trip to India. Enjoy it. You know, namaste.
Yeah, I'll report back.
Yeah, do. And we will see if we can't help Jamestown out. I like the idea that cyclists are getting involved in this kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much. It's a fantastic event, and it's a great place. And if anyone is ever out in the Front Range and when these roads are rebuilt, they definitely got a ride to Jamestown because it's a beautiful place.
All righty. Thanks, okay. Thomas. Have a great night.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye. Thomas Prenn joined me from his home in Boulder, Colorado. He's off to India in the not-too-distant future. He's not going to be there very long, but I'll tell you what, I think it sounds like a cool thing. So that's our show for this evening. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back next week with a brand new edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. I hope the weather's good and you're able to ride. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.